I'm going to call to order the JPAC meeting for November of 2017 and look around the room and it looks at none. And it looks like we have a quorum. And so the first thing on our agenda is we'll go around the room and introduce ourselves. My name is Craig Wurtzel. I am a Metro Council District 3 and Chair of JPAC.
Michelle Belia with Metro, Office of Metro Attorney.
Kelly Brooks. Is ODOT?
Craig, yours wasn't on.
We can't hear you.
That's better.
Yeah, that's great. I'm aware. That's
great. We have a win to leave down.
We can hear you.
Enjoy your music, though.
I want it on.
Shirley Craddock, Mentor Counselor.
And Neil McFarland with TriMet.
Nina DeConcini with DEQ.
Jeff Land, Mayor of Finance, representing the cities of Washington.
Emerald Bug, Portland.
Rick Holm, City Manager, City of Vancouver.
Tim Knapp, Mayor of Wilsonville, representing cities of Clackamas County.
Bob Stacey, Mentor Counselor.
Lori Stegman, Multnomah County Commission, District 4.
Tim Clark, Mayor of Wood Village, representing Multnomah County Cities.
Chris Strickler, Washington State DOT.
Dan Zaltzman, City of Portland.
Grand Mission Metro.
Oh, that was a good time to do this. I would like to introduce to you, we have a new Deputy Director of Planning and Development. This is Barbie Brennan.
Yay,
Barbie. Matt Rams from RTC. Mark Bernard, Washington State DOT.
Kristen Block, Washington County. Jamie Huff, City of Hempstead.
Barbara Cardinal, Clackamas County.
Chris Moore, City of Portland. Tracy Moore, Clackamas County. Hi, everyone. Nicole Hendricks, City of Wilsonville Smart Training.
Good morning. Wiper Shearer, City of Wilsonville Smart. Tom Mark Rathbun.
Very well.
Very good. That's a pilot.
Mark Gamba, Mayor of Milwaukee.
Good. 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 Good.
Good. Good. Good. Good. Good. Good.
Good. Good. State Representative.
Welcome. Thank you.
Yes, thank you, Chair Dirksen. I really appreciate everyone's attendance at both the Finance Committee and also the involvement and continued involvement, frankly, of our bond-related task force. As Chair Dirksen noted, we believe that 2018 was not a feasible date for us for a number of reasons. We, as we all know, accomplished a great deal with the help of some great legislators and some great leadership with HB 2017. But related to our Plan A, which was really Southwest Corridor Light Rail and the three major congestion reduction projects that we're still all focused on as a region, that those projects have a number of prerequisites associated with HB 2017, including, for example, the congestion pricing study and other steps along the way. So we began to see, well, are there other projects that are viable to begin to match this multimodal approach that we had been talking about and planned? And bottom line is that we just do not have the time to be able to put that package of projects together. We know we received an initial listing from all the county coordinating committees in the city of Portland. A long list required a certain amount of vetting and frankly, shortening the list ultimately. But that seemed to be just too much to ask for between now and the deadlines associated with really doing a good campaign and a successful campaign at the same time. And then I'd also just note that there was a lot of interest from other stakeholders about a broader panoply of issues, including housing, that had come up in the conversation. And TriMet, as you know, is a single-purpose agency. We're a transit agency. And there are some limitations in our scope in that regard. So it is appropriate if we're beginning to think about a broader package of regional priorities to pass the baton to Metro. And so that was essentially the conclusion that we shared with the JPAC Finance Committee, which I think endorsed that notion strongly, as well as our business stakeholder task force, which met again later in the week. I think everybody, for example, is focused on the need for housing investment in the region. Our task force, as well as the JPAC Finance Committee, I think generally recognizes the need. There's a lot of discussion about how that will happen and what that really means. But nonetheless, I think the consensus was that this is really the right direction for the region, is to really focus and put a lot of energy into 2020. And indeed, that was the message to our task force, which is we need you now more than ever in terms of the advice that they'll be giving us in terms of forming the committee. So there was a bit of a baton handoff between Bernie staffing the committee to Andy Shaw staffing the committee earlier this week. So I'm happy to answer any questions about that, but I think many of you were at the JPAC Finance Committee and were part of that. So thank you for the opportunity to share that.
Thank you. Any questions, Mr. Department? This was on Monday. That was the second meeting of this subcommittee. And at the first meeting that we had the month before,
I just wanted to just note that on Friday we struck an agreement with the ATU 757 for another three-year labor agreement, which is actually 2 years in the future. And it included, I think, a number of certain gains for labor, but also a number of improvements for us in terms of our ability to contract out certain kinds of work, including the midlife rehabilitation of our aging light rail fleet. So we'll be able to do that, I think, in a lot more cost-effective way with a lot less impact on our own facilities and staffing. So we're very pleased about that. I just wanted to share that, again, I think this is a win for both sides and a very, and obviously always very difficult contract negotiations, but nonetheless a very good outcome in my view.
Congrats.
Oh, I also wanted to share that the regional transportation plan update is continuing, and the next RTP leadership forum will be March 2nd, 2018, for that on your calendar. The regional leadership forums are where the Metro Council brings together JPAC and MPAC to provide direction on the 2018 regional transportation plan update. So that's a Friday, March 2nd. Will be held at the Oregon Convention Center. The forum will be our chance to discuss the draft RTP investment strategy, talk about how these investments perform, and direct staff on how to refine the investment strategy to best meet our regional needs for our transportation system within our budget. At the first three forums, we had community and business leaders with us at the table to help inform our conversations. This fourth forum was always intended to be more focused on the conversation between the Metro councilors and community members, but the council has still asked that staff ensure that if there is a role also for community and business at the forum and continuing through the rest of the RTP process. I also want to share that staff has developed an interactive map of the draft RTP investment strategy projects that have been submitted by all the jurisdictions this summer. It can be found at our website, www.oregonmetro.gov/2018projects. Staff will provide more information at our December meeting, and all those draft projects are all available online at that time. Does anybody else have anything else they'd like to share before we get into the meat of our agenda? If not, then we move forward to the consent agenda. We're considering two items, the minutes for October 19th meeting, and also the resolution 1748-53 for the proposed adding or amending existing project to the 2018-21 MTIP to add and amend the remaining new House Bill 2017 awarded projects, plus to add or amend 2018 MTIP projects that require implementation correction. Is there any discussion on those items, or do I have a motion to approve the consent agenda?
Approve the consent agenda.
Second.
Motion and a second. Any discussion on the items? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Thank you. Next item, for other information and discussion, is value pricing presentation from ODOT. And I believe Mandy Cutting is here to give us that presentation. Come on over here.
Good morning. My name is Mandy Putney. I'm the major projects.
The red light is off. That means the mic is on.
You need to be close.
Bring it close. Okay. Can you hear me?
Yes. Just your voice, not the mic.
Can you hear me now?
Yes, there you go.
Okay.
Yeah, just pull the mic closer to you.
Move it.
Great. My name is Mandy Putney. I'm the Major Projects Manager for ODOT in Region 1, and this morning I'm going to provide an update on our value pricing feasibility analysis that is just about to get underway. Before I do that, I'm going to provide a little bit of a background of how we got here to talking about value pricing an overview of what value pricing is, and then we'll get into the process we're going to follow moving forward. As the region continues to grow, we're experiencing worsening congestion, and those congested periods, which used to be combined to the morning peak and the afternoon peak, are now encroaching into the middle of the day. These trips are now taking longer, which is an impact to commuters and passengers, as well as to freight and public transportation. It's not just the people in Portland who are experiencing the congestion in the metro area. Last year, the Governor's Transportation Vision Panel and the Legislature's Joint Committee on Transportation Preservation and Modernization toured the state and listened to Oregonians from all parts of the state who echoed the need to really make improvements in the transportation system in the Portland region. The congestion here is increasingly affecting our trade-based economy, increasing costs to move goods and services, and making our businesses less competitive. The challenge we face in Portland is that congestion is growing rapidly. As population has increased, we see hours of congestion that have increased between 2013 and 2015. Congestion increased over 13%, and hours of delay has now increased over 22%. This is affecting quality of life of the people that live here and our statewide economy. The legislature, after listening to transportation concerns from Oregonians around the state and learning how congestion here really was impacting the entire region and the state, the legislature took a comprehensive approach to addressing congestion with House Bill 2017. There is money that was invested directly into state and local road projects throughout the state. Some of the targeted investments in the Portland region include ramp connector lanes on I-5 at the Rose Corridor, which will save motorists 2.5 million hours that are currently wasted in gridlock each year, and similar connector lane improvements on Oregon 217 to improve safety and reliability of that corridor. Significant funding from new sources will create public transportation and bicycle and pedestrian improvement projects, providing more people options to get around so they won't need to get into their cars. There's also investments in freight rail through Connect Oregon, allowing us to move products from farm, forest, and factories to markets across the world. And then one additional tool was added to our toolbox, value pricing, as a tool that could potentially reduce congestion and improve reliability. When you hear about value pricing, there often are two typical types of value pricing that have been implemented in the United States. Both of them have been implemented to our neighbors in the north in Washington, the Puget Sound area. The first one is tolls on a bridge or a section of a highway that vary by time of day, where the toll is higher during the peak congested period and not as high off-peak. This sort of value pricing has often been used as a financing mechanism as a bridge is being replaced or a section of highway is being widened. The 520 floating bridge up in the Puget Sound area and the Tacoma Narrows Bridge are examples of this. All lanes are tolled on these projects. The other one is managed lanes. You often hear of express lanes, or you hear of HOT, or high occupancy toll lanes. Those are lanes that often used to be HOV lanes, carpool lanes, that have been converted to a managed lane or a toll lane. And then single occupancy users can opt to pay and to use that lane instead of joining a carpool. I'll provide a brief overview of federal tolling statutes and state policy, and then I'm going to move into talking about the feasibility analysis that we're going to do here. There are many federal restrictions on tolling interstate highways. In general, federal law allows for imposing tolls on interstates if you're reconstructing or replacing bridges, if you're adding a new lane, and then you can toll that new capacity, or again, if you're converting a high occupancy lane into a toll lane. There are two different pilot programs that are managed by the federal government. The Interstate Reconstruction and Rehabilitation Pilot Program is one of them. This program currently has three openings. And this program can be used to toll projects that are reconstruction or rehabilitation projects that need toll dollars in order to complete a finance package. The other program is the value pricing pilot program. It hasn't been widely used, but was used by WashDOT to impose tolls on 520 before construction began. Minnesota DOT has also used it to close a gap between HOV lanes, and Virginia used it to toll a pair of tunnels as they were being reconstructed. This is a program that does provide more flexibility for options to consider. Oregon has a current spot in this program, and we will be seeking to extend our spot. We don't know yet how expansive FHWA's ability is to approve projects under this authority because it hasn't truly been tested. As a reminder, the Transportation Commission in Oregon is the authority to establish tolls here on state facilities, and then toll revenues that are collected on those facilities are subject to the Oregon Constitution, which does require that those funds would be spent on roadway improvements. And this is really focused on Oregon facilities. There's no prohibition for local governments moving forward with looking at tolling on local roads. So now I'm going to move into the feasibility analysis section of the presentation. As I mentioned, House Bill 2017 provided the direction for the Transportation Commission to move forward and develop a proposal to submit to the Federal Highway Administration that would seek approval to implement value pricing on I-5 and I-205. The parameters for that proposal are the state line to where the two corridors intersect in Oregon. Those are the parameters. There's no requirement to do the entire corridor or to start or end at either of those boundaries, but we will look at that area. Again, these are two important corridors in the Portland metro region with significant amount of freight traffic passing through. The Transportation Commission took the legislation and directed the Department of Transportation to form a policy advisory committee as one way to bring diverse viewpoints around the table and to inform their effort and the development of this proposal. This policy committee has been formed and meets for the first time on Monday. This committee will be looking at the best locations to implement value pricing in a way to reduce congestion in I-5 and I-205 in the Portland region. They'll look at the type of value pricing to implement, so what's the application here, and then what are potential mitigation strategies that can be evaluated further. This slide shows the organizations that are represented on the Policy Advisory Committee, including elected officials from both sides of the river, freight and business interests, environmental advocates, advocates for low-income families, for social equity. And we are looking forward to all of their input as we move forward. The committee has been asked by the Transportation Commission to consider a variety of factors as they look at options for I-5 and I-205, and has opened the door to add others if the policy committee deems that's necessary. So factors really range from revenue that might be available after implementation and maintenance costs, traffic operation improvements on the corridor, thinking about diversion of trips that aren't taken on a tolled corridor, and that diversion could include trips that go to other routes or trips that go to transit, as well as trips that aren't taken. What are the social equity impacts, impacts to the community, the economy, and the environment? What is the broader public commenting on these different options that will be considered? Confirming they're consistent with state law and policy, considering feasibility under federal law or expected feasibility under one of these pilot programs, how implementing value pricing may affect project delivery for other high-priority projects discussed in House Bill 2017. And so at the first meeting of the policy committee, they will begin talking about these considerations as well as performance measures to go along with each of them. We expect that the committee will meet about six times between now and next summer. And during those meetings, which are all open to the public and will be videotaped and summarized for people that aren't able to attend, they'll walk through a process where they're thinking about evaluation criteria and performance measures, move forward to confirming the concepts that will be evaluated. The evaluation will be done in conjunction with Metro and ODOT and a consultant team and RTC. So that's kind of our core modeling group. We'll be using the Metro model as the basis of our analysis and then running a toll optimization model on top of that. And then we will come back to the committee with the findings, refine them, move forward, and discuss mitigation opportunities. This analysis, this feasibility analysis, is defined again to identify the type of value pricing and the location. It will not be the final analysis that happens. So after a proposal is submitted and accepted by FHWA, we would need to move forward with a national environmental policy level analysis. And so that scope and that process will be determined once we know what we're evaluating. Along with the policy committee meetings, we will implement a robust public engagement education effort, which will also be starting now that we're starting policy committee. So we have a website up, and we'll have a variety of in-person and online options for folks to engage with a conversation along the way. I'm happy to take questions.
Any questions?
Thanks, Ms. Putney. That's a very helpful discussion and description. I just sort of, it's a two-part question. First, you have your slide that shows types of value pricing. You show two types. Three more occur to my mind. There's full facility tolling as opposed to hot lanes only on a facility like I-5 or 205. There's cordon pricing, which has been used in exotic locations like Singapore, but also somewhat English-speaking locations like Stockholm. And it's been discussed in the Bay Area and New York City, where you have a line around the downtown or other area and charge the tolls they go through. And then there's the sort of ubiquitous tolling that relies on a transponder or other device like Origo inside the cars, where wherever you're driving within the tolled area, you would, based on the time of day, be assessed a toll. I think it's useful to have all those on the table as you go through the analysis, so I'd ask if that's going to be the case. And then with respect to rolling this out and choosing locations for a test, there's two things going on. I look at House Bill 2017's language as saying essentially the commission shall implement value pricing on I-5 and 205 from the state line to the junction in Oregon. It doesn't say segments up. So a decision to go to the feds and say we'd like permission for a test or a demonstration, I think you should be prepared to explain to the legislature if you're not going to seek tolling on the full facilities as to why it doesn't make sense, as opposed to assuming that you don't have to ask for that in the first place. It seems that's the first step that the commission and the department have to take, is asking the feds for approval for how big the canvas will be. And so I'd suggest that you consider asking for the full canvas and then squinching down as seems appropriate based upon your further analysis. Just any thoughts you have about that at this early stage?
Sure. So for the first part, there are other forms of value pricing. I talked about the two most common forms. The first one about tolling in the bridges or tolling sections of a corridor that are being replaced is similar to, you know, all lanes of a, you know, that was a smaller segment, but you could apply that to a full corridor as well. Cordon pricing is in use in a couple locations. That requires tolling at multiple points. We will not be considering cordon pricing for this effort. We are looking at I-5 and I-205. And so, again, cordon pricing would involve other streets or local streets, and so those don't fall under the purview of the Transportation Commission. So that effort, that conversation is not precluded by our feasibility analysis, but we really are trying to be successful by making sure we're very clear about the scope of what we can accomplish in this feasibility analysis. But there will be a broad overview of those options provided at our committee meeting on Monday, and some more conversation about why they're not applicable right now for this analysis. The other question in terms of seeking FHWA approval, our goal is to do enough evaluation and analysis that we're able to figure out where are the location or locations that were able to be most effective at managing congestion on these corridors, and it might be that that's a full corridor approach of implementing value pricing, or it might be that there are certain segments that make more sense. So the analysis that we do will be able to clarify that.
Thanks, Rebecca.
Yeah.
Chair, I think it's important to Councilor Stacy may have a little bit of a misunderstanding of what 2017 is supposed to do. There was a lot of discussion around whether the entire corridor was going to be tolled or whether just segments, and every legislator who participated actively in that understood that it was going to likely be just segments. In fact, the Representative Herrera-Butler's comments about we're going to get hammered with this are really premature, because in all likelihood we're not even going to see the tolling up in the northern part of these sectors, because we're not going to be adding new lanes, we're not going to be doing the kind of changes to those that would trigger our ability under the federal guidelines to be able to toll. So I think we need to be careful about promulgating that story that the whole circle is going to be told. That was never the thing. Well, and it's too bad if that's the impression that you get from the statute, because that's really contrary to what the discussion was.
Thank you. Somewhat similar concerns. I'm looking at the timeline and the steps that are outlined there. It's not clear in that outline to me that there's early addressing the art of the possible, and the possible is going to be determined somewhat by what federal law will or won't allow, and it seems to me that determining those sideboards, if you wish, early enough that then you can strategize within those sideboards would be a laudable goal to find an efficient way to really make something happen other than just conceptualize, sort of what might be nice, without dealing with what really could be done, unless you think you can get federal law changed, and I don't know if that's within the timeline that we're talking about here. Probably not. So just from a pragmatic standpoint, I would encourage the group to early in that timeline get a real clear idea about what those rules and the pilot projects conceptually would likely be limited to or would likely be guided toward, and not spend a lot of time working on things that aren't going to be possible.
Yeah.
But, that's sort of a management kind of a question to the whole thing, and just my reaction to what I'm seeing. So.
I really appreciate hearing all this. I'm going to be sitting on this committee, and so all this I hear this morning will be very helpful when we meet on Monday morning. I think what we can do in order to utilize the timeline we have as efficiently as possible is that I think you're absolutely correct that one of the first things that needs to be done is explore the legality and the cycle of what is what is possible.
Right.
But that doesn't keep us at the same point that process is going on to move forward with, you know, as the first couple of things, say, establish what are our goals and objectives, what do we want to do with this, and then come up with an initial range of concepts. We can do that at the same time that that process is going on. And then when we find out what kind of constraints we might have, then we can adjust that, but there's nothing keeping us from beginning that definition of trying to define what it is we want to even accomplish with this and what we possibly can. So,
if I may just
sure.
Come. I will let you know that we have FHWA that will be there on the committee providing their input as they go along. Part of the challenge, though, is that we do know that there is flexibility with the value pricing pilot program that has not been tested yet. And so it does add a little bit of uncertainty to moving forward with the analysis because it might be that we evaluate something that hasn't been tested before in terms of FHWA approval, but may be possible. So we will be in close contact with FHWA both at meetings and elsewhere, so that they're able to provide that input as we go along.
My question is really about whether or how we're seeking to learn from other states or jurisdictions that have done this well. This has been done in various ways all over the country, and I imagine there's some places that are more comparable to us than others. And so do you have some initial thoughts on states or regions that are the most comparable to us here, or whether or not this effort will look at that?
Yes, and we have a consultant team on board that has national and international experience with value pricing projects. And we have Mr. Strickler on the committee to help provide input from Washington. We have been collecting case studies from around the country and know that some of them are applicable. There are lessons learned that we can gather and that others have had a different set of possibilities because they already had an HOV system, for example, that was fully established. So there are many examples of express lanes that used to be carpool lanes, and so the conversion process there was something that they could discuss that, you know, we don't have that as a starting point. So our intent is to learn what we can from others and also to be clear about what's directly applicable and not, but part of the challenge is that every location really is unique, and so we do want to make sure we have a solution that works for us here.
Mr. Holtz.
Thank you. First, wanted to express our appreciation to the OTC for being able to participate in the committee, along with some other colleagues from Southwest Washington, including Chris and representative from the county. Regretfully, our typical delegate couldn't be here. I'm kind of a fourth string representative of Vancouver, but because this conversation was going on, wanted to make sure that we were sitting here. A couple of questions, and the city has not taken any formal position on this yet, despite what speculation may be in the media. The only formal position we have taken, actually, is in opposition to the Herrera-Butler Amendment, because it's overly broad and doesn't reflect a systems approach. So, but that was one of my questions is, there's clearly this is an Oregon initiative. It's got to be focused on the Oregon system, but Oregon side of the system, but it is a system that spans both states. So to what degree do we anticipate the conversation to be able to look beyond the state line at system-wide implications? And then the second question is NEPA process. That's not a small endeavor. So when you think about an overall timeline, if there is an ultimate implementation, what would that look like?
For the first part, the traffic analysis that's run, we'll be using both the statewide model and the metro model so that if we have a scenario that involves a toll on the northern end of I-5, we'd be able to capture diversion that happened, you know, quite a bit north of that if needed. And so I think I think you'll be able to see those results with our modeling work that's done kind of at the high level. Like, for example, is there diversion that happens to Highway 30? So that would be included. We will, does that helpful? I don't know that there would be as much need to look at the local street network in Vancouver, but at the high level, you'll see that information. And then in terms of the NEPA process, we're not sure what that looks like now. And that will be part of the work that we do as we're identifying the alternative, is to think through what would the next steps be. So some of the implementation options could result in a longer NEPA process and others a shorter NEPA process. So I envision that part of what we submit to FHWA will be our identification of what we think our next steps are in terms of further evaluation.
Thank you. This conversation raises a question in my mind whether WSDOT has expressed an interest or been invited to form a Washington committee that would be a subset of this committee so they could look at the issue on that side of the river at the same time they're looking on this side of the river, if they really want to be involved in the dialogue about what the possibilities are. I don't know if that has happened or not.
Address that. At this point, we don't have any plans to form a separate committee. While the work is going on, we will obviously be paying close technical attention, as well as, frankly, the potential impact to Washington residents. I'm comforted to hear, frankly, just of the conversation about different areas within the corridors for tolling, because that will have a big impact on equity for Washington residents and the level of participation that comes from other entities, frankly, within Southwest Washington. So at this point, no specified technical committee to continue working on it, but staff as well as local agencies will be working on that.
Thank you for that. Any other questions from Ms. Putney, or any other thoughts or comments that any of the other members of the committee here would like to share with me as we go into this round of meetings? As I said, the first one will be Monday morning. All right, well, we'll be
sure to the class. Oh. Let me just make one more comment, if I might. This question about tolling is a really sensitive political question, as you might expect. And it probably generated more conversation around House Bill 2017 than any other single element. It is critical, I think, for us to remember as we look at this, that in order to navigate future transportation improvements in the area, if we are going to toll, we're going to have to show folks that they're getting something for the tolling experience. And the Herrera-Butler concerns seem to revolve around, gee, it's just not fair. You're going to toll a chunk of road and then use that money to fix something else that we're not getting any benefit for. Those kinds of direct correlations are going to be critical as we go through the process of this. So I hope everybody that participates in this process kind of keeps that in mind. If we don't stick to that, it's going to be political suicide in terms of future ability to use that kind of a financing tool.
Good point.
Trying to figure, is that on? Is it on? No, not on.
Anyway, I just wanted to highlight, I appreciate that one of the considerations is
equity impacts. Is it off?
My line is off.
It's counterintuitive. How about now?
Anyway, equity impacts. Representing Multnomah County, I just want to highlight the importance and the cost of transportation to our low-income population, and as we know, housing is incredibly expensive, and transportation is too. So that'll be something that obviously the county will really want to highlight, because I just envision there being this huge inequity for low-income people, and so I want to keep that at the forefront of the conversation. Thank you.
Thank you. Anything else? All right. Well, thank you for coming and giving us the presentation.
My pleasure.
I'm sure there'll be a lot of conversation about that in the next few months. Now we'll come to item on the agenda, our action item for this morning, which is a 2018-2021 stiff process funding from the NPO to the Oregon Transportation Commission on the Blue Mountain Main Street Fund and funding letter. And this is a follow-up on previous letters that we that has been approved by this group in response to the request from ODOT and the OPC for input on their consideration of how that's done. And I've asked if everybody had a chance to look at this. It was in your packet. And I've asked Tim to go over to you with these funding and talk about it. And why don't we bring this again? Because we've sent a letter before, why don't we bring this again?
Okay, thank you, Chair Dirksen. Just going to do a real brief introduction, then I'm going to be turning it over to Grace Cho of our staff to give you some of the more details of the STIP proposal that the Oregon Transportation Commission will be discussing on Friday, and then I think they're scheduled for action at their December meeting. Okay, so I'll talk loudly. Just a real quick overview, just a refresher, remembering that the Metropolitan Transportation Improvement Program and the State Transportation Improvement Program really are a coordinated process for how transportation, federal transportation funding is spent across the state, across our region, and in local communities. And it really is a cooperative process between the MPOs and the state DOT. Differences in the actual oversight of the program, again, part of the TIP process is the allocation of funding to specific projects. Some of that funding is allocated through JPACT and the Metro Council, through the Regional Flexible Fund allocation process that you're familiar with. ODOT also has funding programs that they administer that is directly overseen by the Oregon Transportation Commission. So it's that second bullet point there that we're focusing on today. The first step in this process really is for a revenue estimate to be done on what expected revenues will be coming into a state or into the region. And then so the process right now is the OTC is going through is confirming those revenue forecasts and then assigning those revenues to the various funding allocation programs. And so that's what the OTC is acting on today. And with that, I'm going to turn it over to Grace just to do a real brief overview of the funding that is forecast that the OTC is going to be considering.
So what do we have in store for fiscal years 2022 through 2024, which seems a little ways out, but surprisingly it's fast approaching. There's about an estimated $2.4 billion that's expected to be invested statewide over those fiscal years, and right now they're being proposed across six different funding categories. There's kind of four main funding categories that the JPAC table is probably the most familiar with. These are Fix-It, which is mainly those various like maintenance and operations programs such as like pavement preservation, operations, bridge. Then there's the safety program, which ODOT has developed as they call it the All Roads Transportation Safety Program. Then they have their Enhanced Highway Program, and this is really where enhancements to the highway system is what's mainly comprised of that program. And then the non-highway program, which is a mix of a number of the active transportation, transit kind of programs. So this is everything from their special transportation needs program to the, it includes currently the 1% bike bill funding that typically goes towards active transportation enhancements in the roadway. In addition to those four main categories, there's two pass-through categories, and these are funds that through either like federal legislation or like state various like agreements, these funds actually just get passed through to other entities. So this is actually where the MPO funds and essentially the regional flexible funds comes through. It's also where you have the local funding agreements, like for the cities and counties, to that's coming through the state gas tax. So within each of these programs, they're going to be allocating the funds for fiscal years 22 through 24, and this does include all the new HB 2017 revenues, so that means the new additional funding to the various fix-it maintenance programs, as well as the new revenue coming to safety, and the named projects that were also outlined in the bill. So right now, what's proposed across that $2.4 billion spread across those six different categories, what we're seeing statewide is, you know, in general, a fix-it program that's ranging somewhere in that $750 to $850 million over the course of those three fiscal years, an enhanced highway program that's around $687 million to about $787 million, but I do want to just note that that includes the earmarked projects that came out of the state package, a safety program that's about $150 million statewide, a non-highway program that's a little over $150 million statewide, and then the local programs and the other pass-through program. Namely, that's actually the ODOT's SPR program for like research and planning work. So something just to note about the allocation of the ODOT funds for fiscal years 22 through 24 is that there's three different funding programs that are being proposed to be administered as essentially like leverage programs to fix-it projects, meaning that essentially that the projects that are identified through the various fix-it programs, so through the pavement preservation, through operations, through the bridge program. These would be like the universe of eligible projects that could, essentially look to these other pots of funding to either like implement some sort of like active transportation elements in combination with that fix-it project, or to implement some sort of safety elements to that fix-it project. And clearly that would have to be done, you know, what's makes sense and what's most appropriate and such. So that's just something to note, because this is a little different. They've been kind of moving in this direction from cycle to cycle, but it's a little different from what you may have been familiar with from previous cycles of the ODOT funding allocations. So currently, the OTC has been holding discussions about the funding allocation programs for 21 through 24, and through those conversations, they kind of landed on one of these key main questions at this point. And that's really, what size enhanced highway program should there be for this funding cycle? And that they're really grappling with this question in light of knowing that there's the state package that was passed earlier this year did name a number of capital improvements to the state highway system. So there's two different scenarios that they've laid out. One scenario is looking at a $124 million enhanced highway program that would be statewide, and another is looking at a $24 million program, again, statewide. And for both of these scenarios, that would, again, be allocated through a leverage program. So they'd be looking at doing some sort of highway-based enhancements to, say, a fix-it project, like if you're going to be repaving part of the interstate, then maybe there's a potential like capital improvement opportunity that could be combined with that. So as Councillor Dirksen had mentioned, that we have been, the Portland Metropolitan Region has been engaged throughout the OTC discussion around these funding programs. For the past couple of months, we've come to you asking for you to let staff or approve a letter for staff to submit directly to the OTC so the region can actually bring their voice directly to leadership and express our various thoughts and desires of what we'd like to see come out of these various funding programs. We still feel as though that It's important for us to continue to engage in this process. At this time, there's currently a question that the OTC is asking us about and that they're seeking input on. So we want to be able to go in and express our region's opinions and thoughts about that. So the key outcome of the comment letter that we're the aim that we're seeking to achieve, and I should say that we actually what you have in front of you is a copy of the comment letter. We had readapted it slightly from the one that you saw in the packet. It's quite a bit shorter, and then there's an attachment that kind of explains more in depth the details of the logic behind our various comments. But the key things that we wanted to get across is, one, we wanted to respond to the OTC question at hand. And second, we want to be able to reiterate positions from our October comment letter that we don't see currently reflected in the current OTC proposal. And just as a reminder, too, about what we said in our October comment letter, the gray item in your packet on the first page of the JPAC cover memo, it lists the five key points that we had expressed in the comment. So we, because of the timing and the timeline, we ended up having to do an ad hoc meeting with various TPAC members because we wanted to be able to gather some input about what we should say in this comment letter, and it ultimately got us to kind of those two main principles, as well as we took advantage of being able to hear the conversation at the recent Region 1 ACT meeting and listen to how that conversation went and being able to shape some of our comments based off of that. And with that, I'm going to turn it over to Ted to explain our comments.
So great. So really four main comments to refine our previous comments to really hone in on what the OTC will be talking about on Friday. So just real briefly, the four comments are to, in terms of that question of what level of investment to put into the enhancement program, of the two options they're considering, a $24 versus $124 million, is that we are advocating a moderate version somewhere in between that amount, with the additional difference going to considering being invested in the safety and the non-highway programs, which is not a specific proposal in front of them today. But in terms of that, this being discretionary revenue, we're asking that they consider putting additional dollars into those two programs. For the leverage programs that they're discussing, we want to make sure that they ensure consideration of the enhancement priorities and local input when selecting those projects. In the past, as that was a new program, those were really sort of driven by the opportunities presented by the fix-it lists themselves and what ODOT could identify as a viable enhancement project to a fix-it project. Given that they're talking about more resources going into a leverage program, we want to make sure that the opportunity to have local input on an enhanced project that's prioritized might be able to lift up a combined enhanced fix-it project, and to really consider local input and the effectiveness of that leverage program or that leverage project in prioritizing the combined projects. We're also asking that all of their programs develop what are called shelf projects, which is in case more revenue becomes available than they are currently forecasting. They have a moderately conservative forecast. So as new revenues become available, that they are able to invest in a new project across any program and not just traditionally the ones that are usually shelf ready, which is a fix-it project. And then the fourth comment is for the safety funding that they're considering, is that they the $30 million of the safety leverage program, that they use a data and jurisdictionally blind approach to investing those dollars, similar to their existing arts program, and that they're really prioritizing safety dollars on the most effective safety problems, or fixing the worst safety problems in terms of fatal injuries and fatalities and serious injury crashes. So that's the gist of the letter itself, and with that, we'll open it up for discussion.
Questions for staff or comments on the letter?
Thank you. Interesting concepts. I think there's a logic to them. I spent 15 minutes reading the attached memo, and I could not outline for you from that 15 minutes of work exactly what the region is asking.
I think it's more complex and difficult to follow than most committee members will spend the time to discern, and I would encourage a edit of the attached memo into sub-bullet points with a short rationale after each bullet point, or something that I think you could grasp much more carefully than trying to read through all the verbiage and find, oh, here's what the region is asking, or here's what the region position, because those are scattered through those paragraphs throughout, and I find that difficult to follow. Maybe everybody else doesn't, but that's my reaction to it.
So I just would ask it. So you were reading the attachment, the what was in the packet? Is that correct?
No, I'm reading this.
The attachment. Right. Okay. So the purpose of the cover memo was to, I think, try to do what you were describing. But then the idea was that the attachment would provide more detail that really ODOT staff could read through and understand more specifically. And so really, we were trying to get it capture that sort of higher level vision with this cover letter itself. Are you asking that we also just further edit down the attachment as well?
That would be my thought on it. And as I said, to me, going to sub bullet points, you know, and then having a short rationale after each sub bullet point, if you wish, instead of having to read through that much verbiage and try to pick out what the regional asks are and the rationale for those regional asks, which is a fairly extensive project with this much stuff, even though it's 2.5 pages.
Thank you.
We'll see if this works. It does work, see? It's the magic. It's the magic. First of all, I just want to indicate I'm going to abstain, and the reason I'm abstaining is obviously as chair of the Act, we have already sent a letter. Many of you, including you, Mr. Chairman, are on that committee. I know that you indicated at that meeting that there were some other additional things that you wanted to include, but a robust group, I think, of not only folks that are here, but also business folks were on that Act committee. So I just want to say there's nothing that you've indicated that is particularly troublesome. It's points that you've made before, but I think it's a very confused message to give to OTC from its Act that, gee, we're supporting one letter here and one letter there. The big difference is, obviously, is we both are going for scenario one. That's fine, but I can't say, and you were there, and Kelly, you were there as well, that that was a split vote that we finally came to consensus on. There were many who wanted fix it instead of the enhance, and you'll recall that. Your comments were a little more pointed at wanting communication back from the OTC, where ours were more suggestive. We didn't think we were in a position to tell them what to do, and so I thought that was a bit of a difference. You have more funds focused on other off-road kinds of investments than we had. We didn't indicate that. We also gave some flexibility in terms of the enhanced money was enough, which never is. But ODOT Region 1 suggested that the fix-it money was enough to take care of some of the needs, not all, but some of the needs. If we needed to have them dip into the fix-it or into the enhanced to do some of the fix-it, that we would suggest that as well. So there's some subtle differences, and I certainly appreciate the staff work, and I certainly appreciate that the MPO has a legitimate role to say something, but very awkward for those of us who have to present to OTC and say, yeah, I said this, and then I said this, and they said, well, what are you really saying? So I'll abstain, and I suspect, Kelly, you're going to abstain too.
Yes, I am going to abstain. I tend to abstain on all letters to ourself, usually as practice. But yes, I do. I'll just flag a couple things. One, I Chair Dirksen, thank you for coming to the ACT meeting and really robustly participating in that discussion with us. So I do believe that a lot of these issues are touched on. The ACT has sent a letter as well, and so that is helpful. I'll just put a final point on the first bullet about the NS Highway. The range between 24 and 124 is pretty consistent with the conversation that happened around the ACT table. The recommendation that you put it on non-highway and safety, I just want to underscore Ted's point, that is not currently on the table as an option for the OTC, so that's a brand new item that will be coming directly from JPAC to the OTC to consider. And I guess the only other request I'd have sort of going forward is this is, despite my attempts to make it as easy to understand as possible, a fairly complex topic. There's a lot of different fund types that are merging into one. So if the NPO, I know that you'll want to continue to talk about the STIP as we go through the 21-24 process, to the extent you would be amenable to having ODOT staff present, I think that will be helpful just so people are hearing kind of seeing some of the same information in both forums, obviously with opportunities to chime in or refine or clarify as needed, but that would be my one request as we proceed, just so folks can kind of see the same, at least the same charts, you know, at a couple different places. But other than that, I've appreciated all the input that we've gotten and the different forums and opportunities that you all have provided for folks to weigh in. I think this is a brand new level of engagement, I would say, in terms of this part of the STIP process. And a lot of the issues that you're raising here will actually get refined as we proceed into the next step. So essentially, they're defining the buckets and filling the buckets of the funds on the enhance and fix it side. There will be a lot of questions that need to get answered as we proceed into the needs list, where you'll have the shelf question, for example, may very well end up really getting refined in that environment, right? You know, here's the target that you have for this particular program. We would expect that some percentage of that target be for design only of projects. So just stay engaged, stay involved, because some of those things will get worked out down the road. Keep things at a higher level as we talk to the representatives.
with that, and after listening to comments, it would be my recommendation that we consider the letter as presented this morning to go to the OTC. And I can make that recommendation, but as the chair, I can't make that motion. So,
I have a question. And maybe Kelly or Penny can talk about it. And you might not know this at this stage, but what are the trade-offs conceptually of investing in discretionary revenues in the non-highway safety funding programs when the delta is that big?
So you're talking about the trade-offs for that $100 million difference? Yeah. So it really is a matter of where you're. So the OTC has discretion about where to put the $100 million across those different programs. And right now the option is, are you going to put it in HANCE or are you going to put it in the Fix-It programs? And what we're saying and at each level. And so that's how it's being presented to them. I think what you've heard both at the ACT and from the letter of recommendation here is somewhere in between, but the difference being with ours is saying invest some discretionary revenue in these other two programs because they're deserving of some of the discretionary as well, as opposed to just the minimum. I can't tell you exactly how many fewer Fix-It projects might come out versus how many additional safety projects might come out or how many additional non-highway projects might come out. And we've kind of left that open to them to sort of come up with an appropriate level, but we are asking them to consider doing more than the minimally required, for lack of a better word, in those other two programs. So in terms of project trade-offs, that really won't come out until they actually start picking projects, I think. But
yeah, but just at a high level to get inside the brain of OTC and what they're grappling with when that trade-off question, there was this, a set level of investments that they outlaid in their strategic investment strategy prior to HB 2017 of where they would like to get the asset condition of the system, what they would like to invest in terms of congestion relief projects. The ball went out really far away in terms of investing in those maintenance projects. But it didn't quite hit all the marks that they'd have to get to in terms of bridge and prize and other areas. And so that's for them. They're asking them what trade-off the commission is looking at. They're saying, okay, how much closer can they get to those targets we set in the investment strategy versus put it elsewhere? So.
Abstentions.
Abstentions. Sorry.
Thanks.
Okay. All right. Wonderful. Thank you, everyone.